This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Vicky Marie Buchanan,
David John Jones,
A. Yearly,
Jane Bolton,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now, John, you went to a very old school in Wales.
Yes, I went to Friars Grammar School, which was founded in 1557, and it was an old school that was tied up with the religion of Catholicism, I think.
Yeah.
But that went by the board later on, and the headly title was Freudere Fredere, which means brotherly love, and that was a very
okay.
But it was just a grammar school; it wasn't a private school, just a plain grammar school.
Oh well, plain grammar school—that was a step up from. Was it secondary moderns then?
If the, no, so you no, passed se- an 11 plus. Secondary modern was down.
Yeah, grammar that's school, what I mean. Yeah. So if you passed an 11 plus, and you went
plus,
to the grammar
yes,
school.
Yes, 11 yeah. plus.
Okay.
And one of the things which always amused me was you had to choice at the third form.
Yeah.
Welsh, French, or woodwork. But I took woodwork.
Uh-huh. So, well, yeah. And we can see the results.
Yes.
Because, I mean, how much of... You've got some marvellous carved sort of tables and chairs and so on here. How much of that came from your woodwork training at school, and how much you developed
well,
yourself?
Well, fairly basic stuff at school, so, yeah. So, but the enthusiasm to do more was created by a love of Queen Anne furniture, really, that I really liked that furniture.
Yeah, because you got some lovely designs here. Mm. Now, I'll just mention, so it's on the record, we mentioned the 11 plus. In Britain, there was a system when students would go to school, primary school until 11, they'd take the 11 plus. If they passed it, they went to a grammar school or high school, and if they failed it, they went to a secondary modern. And the grammar school track was heading to professions and university, and the secondary modern was more towards the trades and so on. And then they thought, this is too divisive, deciding on people's future at that age. So they said we should have comprehensive schools and abolish the 11 plus. And there's still some debate on that, I think.
Well, there was quite a wide range of subjects at the grammar school, much more than the secondary mod. Mm. And in my case, I was doing art.
Mm.
And one afternoon in the art class, I took the screws out of a desk.
Yeah.
And the teacher came and sat on the desk. And it collapsed. And I was thrown out of the art class, but I still had to do so many subjects, and the only choice left was scripture.
Oh dear.
And at that stage, when I was about, I was still a sort of a wee bit of a agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see the sense in this, but I had no option.
Yeah.
And the set book for the year was Genesis chapters 1 to so and so. And we, for example, I can enlighten you now that the Genesis was made up of three books: the Aloistic document, the priestly document, and the primitive document. And we had to pick up out of those texts which document they were referring to and learn all that stuff.
Wow.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
So the grammar school was... I liked the grammar school, but...
Yeah, ours was a bit different. We had religious education. I think it was compulsory, and we had someone, we called him Holy Joe, the person who was teaching, but he thought rather than to... He could teach sort of bits of comparative religion, but also he... we all got a book on Soren Kierkegaard and went through some of his thinking and things like that. So it's really quite a diverse approach to religion.
Yes, quite a wide range of subjects. Yeah. People, the real clever guys used to pass sort of 14 subjects at school serve. Because it was English literature, English language, Welsh language, literature, Welsh language. Maths was 3-hour paper in arithmetic, algebra, geometry, trigonometry.
Yes, yes. That's right. Here we've got school certain bursary and so on, but in Britain there was the GCEs, General Certificate of Education, and there was O levels when you do a broad range of subjects, and then A levels after that. Yeah. Yeah, where you specialise a bit more. Yeah.
So then I left school with 3 subjects at school certificate, because I was a bit of a tearaway.
So how old were you then when you left school? How old were you when you left school?
Well, nearly 16.
Okay.
And I then became an apprentice fitter and turner for Saunders Row.
Now, so what did that... You'd be apprentice for 5 years, 3 years?
Yes, yeah.
5 years?
5 years, okay. Yes.
And so, did that include training as well outside, or they just taught you on the job?
We had a 9-month training school period, and then we went out on the shop floors.
Okay.
And I actually built buses, minesweepers, fast patrol boats, things like that. But one of the buses I saw in the museum in Auckland.
Oh, wow.
There's one of the buses, because we supplied knockdown buses for Auckland. And we built fast patrol boats.
Yeah.
So I spent, going to night school as well, I spent 4.5 years there. And then I was accepted to go on what they call the Higher National Diploma in Britain. And I broke my apprenticeship, and that was a sandwich course. So I went...
When you say you broke your apprenticeship, you mean you didn't finish the apprenticeship?
Yes, I remember telling the personnel manager, I'd had a bit of an argument with him a couple of years earlier about being moved around in various shops, and he said, "You'll go where I tell you."
Yeah.
So...
Now, I have to butt in it. People were talking about apprenticeships in other areas here in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And one said that certain people got apprenticed in certain companies and they were just doing the same narrow thing, whereas someone else, he got an apprentice where he was doing this and then something else, and he got a really broad range of skills.
Yeah. Depended on the company, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we went from one shop to another.
Yeah.
So you went to the machine shop, you went to the sheet metalling shop and that sort of thing. And I had to now break my contract.
Yeah.
And I had to go and see the personnel manager.
Yeah.
And he said, "Haven't you forgotten something? You've got a contract with us.
Yeah.
And it's up to me to decide whether you leave or not." And I said, "So you're going to hold me back in my education?" He said, "Yes, if I need to." So I said, "Well, okay, what I'll do then is you hold me back and I'll go to the local newspaper on the way home and tell them a story."
Yeah.
And he fuffled and he said, "All right, then you can go. We're glad to get rid of you," sort of thing.
So was there a penalty, or were they funded for...
No, they had you because you were a contract, so you couldn't go. So, you know, you could leave, but then you broke your... You haven't got your... Well,
so
if you didn't
get
do
no
your 5 years,
at the end,
you went a tradesman.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I went down on this to Wrexham, which is about 120 mile away from Bangor.
Yeah.
And I was doing this diploma course. Now, the diploma sandwich course... 6 months in industry, 6 months at Polytech.
Yeah.
So then I went to a firm called Mather and Platts in Manchester.
Yeah.
And they made centrifugal pumps, big pumps, small pumps, all sorts. Employed about 3,000 people. And I'll never forget the funny part of one of the amusing things as far as I was concerned. when you got paid, on a Thursday you got a disc.
Yeah.
With your clock number on it. And on Friday, you all rushed down to these alleyways.
Yeah.
With clock numbers, so-and-so to so-and-so, and you went down there. And at the end of there was a chap with a wicker basket made out of wire, sort of full of pay packets.
Mm-hmm.
1407, that was my clock number. Right, there we are, and you handed it. And then you went through this alleyway, and especially if it was a windy day, it was like going out into a snowstorm, because the fellas would be tearing up their pastries, you know,
yeah.
And just thought this paper coming back.
Yeah.
And they built centrifugal pumps, as I said. And I'm talking about some of them in the I had to do a period in the foundry.
Mm.
And you'd start off with a hole bigger than this room to put a little piece of the pump. They were that big.
Yeah.
Boiler feed pumps for big power stations.
Yeah.
And so I had that experience. Really enjoyed myself there each time.
Mm.
And I worked on those pumps. I was on the test bed finally, testing pumps.
Mm.
And then I went to... There was in that time there was a period of national service in the army.
Aye. So were you qualified by then? Had you
finished the Polytech four years?
Well, yeah. Was that the equivalent of the apprenticeship? To have completed an apprenticeship?
No. That was completely opposite.
I know it's different, but it sort of equivalent in terms of being qualified?
Well, they had to. You had to, doesn't matter whether you came off the street. If you were accepted to go on the sandwich course, you did the theoretical stuff, and then they put you onto a training firm for 6 months.
But what I mean, you could have finished your apprenticeship and you would have had a certain standing or earning capacity.
Yes.
Instead, you did this qualification.
Yes.
Was that something better, the same, lower, just different?
Much better.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. The diploma is equivalent to a degree in engineering.
Okay.
Because the only way you can get into the Institute of Mechanical Engineers is either to have their qualifications, examinations, a high national diploma, a dip tech or a degree. So that's what I did there. Now, where was I?
Then you had national service.
The national, So that was, well, I didn't do that. I...
you were rebelling right the way through.
What I did then was, I thought, there was a chap at school, a kid at school, Donald Pugh, I can see him now, and he was a sergeant in the army, and the thought of finishing up, being under his wing, being told what to do by that nincompoop, no way was I going to do my national service.
Yeah.
So I went into the Merchant Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you could get out of national service?
Yes, as long as you stuck it till you were 26.
Which would be how long? 5 years? Or?
4 years.
4 years.
4 years.
And national service would have been how long?
Two.
Okay.
See, so
you were really desperate to stay away from
it. But it was good training. It was good.
Yeah.
So then I went. I joined a company called the Pacific Sea Navigation Company, and I went down to South America in the engine room, sort of thing, as an engineer. And
what was that like? Just very hot and stuffy.
Oh, very, very hot. Yeah.
Was it enjoyable?
Yes. Yeah. Boy, I enjoyed that. Yes. Yeah.
Why is that?
I went to a place called what was it called? Antofagasta.
Uh huh.
And I looked, I said to the fourth engineer, I said, look at that up on there, I said, and on the hill out above Antofagasta is a big arrow.
Yeah.
You could really see it from miles away, and written underneath the arrow, Viva Colonel O'Higgins. Yeah. And I said, O'Higgins? I mean, you're in South America and you've got this O'Higgins character. What the hell was he? And he was, in fact, the son of a member of the British Embassy who became a colonel in the Peruvian army, and the Peruvians drove the Chileans out of Ah, it was the other way around. The Chileans drove the Peruvians out of Antofagasta, out of over the border.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, so I was there for about three trips, and then I joined another company, Cunard.
Yeah,
and I was on the Queen Mary as an engineer. So I went.
Wow, what was it? There'd have been a lot of engineers on that, would there? Or
80.
80 engineers.
Yes. 8-0. And there was a second engineer in each engine room.
Yeah.
So that was two. And there was another five engineers in each, chief second engineers in each boiler room. So, and then there was what they called as walking second. And all he did was walk around the engine room. Yeah.
So hang on, you talk about the boiler rooms and the engine rooms. So how many engine rooms were there and how many boiler rooms were there?
Well, there's two engine rooms. There's four shafts.
Yeah.
For the ship, and there was two shafts in each engine room.
Yeah.
And there were five boiler rooms.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they were what they call forced draft boiler rooms, which means the air in the engine room, in the boiler room, was above atmospheric pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So to get in there, you had to go into like a little telephone kiosk.
Oh, so airlock sort of thing.
Airlock. And you went in, closed the door. You couldn't open this door until you closed that one properly. Went in, and that's how you went in the engine.
And that was for what? For ventilation in the engine?
Yeah, well, it would pull the fires in the boilers. Yeah.
Yes, okay.
So, I spent, I thought, well, I've got quite a few years to do what this till I'm,
So how were the boilers powered? Were you there shoveling coal into them all the time?
No.
Oil fired.
Yeah. And you'd had sort of five big burners and they had nozzles and you just switched them on.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, you know, you've seen on films, people going, you know, in the film go slow ahead, stop. They don't realise what's happening because when he goes from full ahead to stop.
Yeah.
Down in the engine room, you've got to stop the engine. Now, you're still making steam, so you've got to knock the fires off. You've got to slow down the fan because you're supplying too much air. And all. So him going like that, they were seeing people running all over the place.
Yes. And then they're sort of like in the battleship, and then suddenly full ahead.
That's it,
So it's quite chaotic down there.
So that National Service all of a sudden stopped. They said, right, we're finishing with it. So I got out.
Hang on, you got out of the Merchant Navy?
Yeah, I just left the Merchant Navy,
You mean you jumped ship or you were allowed out?
You just signed, it's just like a job, really.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And, so what was I going to do now? So I applied for a job in a Hawker Siddeley Dynamics.
Yeah.
And that was a trials engineer. So I got the job.
Trials engineer?
Yeah, we were trialing the Blue Steel missile, which went under the Vulcan bombers.
Underneath those. Yeah.
Well, they were. Well, that's where they were trialed. And so we run trials, we'd have the missile on in the workshop, and we had ways of controlling the air pressure. So it knew what altitude it was at and all the rest of it.
You simulated the
heights and stuff like that.
Okay.
And at a time sort of system to see whether it was going through the program properly.
So hang on, how did that? Because this wouldn't have been all a computer simulation.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, it was.
So
they had computers for all that sort of thing in
the
early 1960s.
There was a CRC computer, CRC now, computer radio control, that's right. And then, and then there was a navigator, and then there was, they were driven by steam turbine. Generator was inside, would generate the power to run this thing, and that was a little steam turbine.
Yeah.
And the heat came from that, was kerosene. And then the back of it was a rocket. So, and we trialed those, but we didn't trial them. All we did was we took them under the Vulcan bomber,
yeah,
jacked them up and tightened bolts,
mm,
and when they flew over, there was a beam inside the Vulcan bomber,
yeah,
so when they took the pen or pressed the button, it was thrown down at 2G, because they bent this beam and the energy stored in it would whoomp,
take it forward.
And they dropped them over the Irish Sea.
Is this like some of the missiles they have, where there's a gentle thing that pushes the missile up to start with, then the engine fires, away it goes?
They used to drop quite a distance.
Okay.
And then, so I was on the trials engineer there. Then the trials started, sort of, we were almost finished. And the funny thing was, they were still sort of way behind as far as deciding whether the things were flying properly. So I then transferred to the stress office.
Hang on, does this mean then that Britain's nuclear deterrence was phony because they didn't know if they even had the delivery system?
Well, they had the delivery system, but they hadn't proved that the missile would stay together. So I went to the stress office then and worked out how to deploy, sort of working out the forces on rivets, what side, whether the rivets were big enough, whether the loading, what sort of loading it was and stuff like that.
So then, years later, when you're in Barmerston North teaching your tech students, you tell them about this, and they were really impressed that you were working on this.
That's right. It was very useful attributes to have, really.
Yeah.
So then I finished there, the stress office, and this is all this fellow John Cotton came to the department, and he was doing maths and a bit of calculus and stuff, and I was, you know, I really love calculus sort of thing, so I was helping him with his homework, but I wasn't doing his homework, I was helping him with and I suddenly thought, geez, I really enjoy this. I thought, and he thought I was reasonably good at it. I applied for this 12 months teacher's training at the Polytech, and I went to Bull Teachers Training College for a year.
Now, just when you came out, you were already married.
Yes.
So were you married at this stage?
Yes, I was married. Not at that. Oh, yes.
Because I was going to say, you sort of jumped around a bit, didn't you? Did you feel that? And I recall at that stage there was the view, sort of, you know, these guys need someone to help them settle down and find a path in life. You hadn't quite reached that stage.
No, I hadn't found my niche. Exactly. Yeah. So I lived in a place called Alderley Edge, which is outside Manchester.
Yeah.
Lovely little place. And I went to Macclesfield, which was 10 miles over the hill, and worked there for a year, and then I'd applied for a post in New Zealand, and lo and behold, I got the job in Queen Elizabeth College.
So did that involve things like interviews at New Zealand House in London or anything like that?
No, but basically you've got a teacher's certificate, and you've got the qualifications, and that was about it, really.
So no interview or anything?
No, just interview.
Just based on paper, you look at
the other thing was,
Had you had much teaching experience?
Oh, yes, I had a year.
Okay.
A year, more or less, plus little snippets of, you know, while I was training. And I then got came to Queen Elizabeth College, and the Polytech started up, so I was doing night school, apprentices and technicians, and then I translated to the Queen Elizabeth, to the Polytech full complete sort of thing, and that's what it was till I retired. And I really enjoyed it. I loved it.
So when did you start doing your furniture making? In retirement or before that?
Well, the woodwork. I was
always
split up from my first wife and I met my second wife, and I, you know, I was boozing and stuff, and I thought, no, I'm going to give it away. So I said, I'm packing it up, and that's what I did. And so, and I was saying earlier, I thought, well, what am I going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
And my father had got some tools that I'd got, and I thought, oh, I could do woodwork.
Yeah. So, at what stage, after you retired from teaching, or before that?
Oh, no, before that, quite a while, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of work on the house, believe it or not. I put that room in.
Yeah.
That room wasn't there. And these would just rollers, sliders here. I put the bay windows in and stuff like that. So I, yeah, so I got stuck into the woodwork, and I really enjoyed, you know.
So you'd have worked with wood and with metal. Do you have a preference for wood over metal? Or?
Well, I, you know, screw cutting and things like that and machining to a tolerance, yes.
Yeah.
See, woodwork's a lot easier.
Yeah.
But yeah. I enjoy the engineering side.
Yeah.
And I've made, you know, see a lot of that, this stuff here.
Mm.
These.
Yeah, like the table. You've got the edging on the table
here,
and so on.
And all the,
yeah.
Though you need a spindle moulder. So
okay.
I got one. So
you
I went down to the local foundry, made the patterns up.
Yeah.
In
so you made your own tools, basically.
Made the the castings, I machined them.
Yeah.
And then made my own spindle moulder and drill and two other things.
This is part 2 of 3. Listen next week for part 3.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website. And a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.